What's up, punks? Today is a special edition of Block Digest, where we are bringing on Ben Woolsey, a Bitcoin Core contributor working on an interesting CoinJoin-related project called Snowball. So you want to say hi to everybody, Ben?
Hello.
And Janine, what is up today?
Just teaching crypto things to people at parties.
All right.
The question is, though, are they sober enough to retain the lessons?
Well, these people definitely were, and that's a good thing because apparently there's highly dangerous equipment in the building I was in that could kill you. So it was a highly political debate about whether people should be allowed to access these machines.
Interesting. So not going to get any more details than just building dangerous things, arguing.
Let's just say they had a machine with a laser, and yeah, it's on lockdown.
Okay. I guess we'll move along from that. Ben, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you kind of fell into Bitcoin and winded up contributing to Bitcoin Core?
All right. Yeah. So I got familiar with Bitcoin in the first place around 2012, I think, and really just was a passing interest. I liked the goal of the project and the spirit of it, but it seemed like an experiment to me. And then as time went on, I started adopting it in different ways. So for example, for rent payment, things like that. And then it wasn't until 2017 that I really decided to commit myself to it and to sort of work on it, to make it my daily work. And that happened in the context of, you know, there was a lot going on in that year. There was the block size debate, the ICO boom, things like that. And I was at a time, I'd been working on web development in startups in San Francisco. And I was planning to, I had left one job, was planning to start another. And I took time off just in between and spent a few weeks reading white papers and watching videos. And it was seeing a real description of the Lightning Network that tipped me over. It was there's a talk by Joseph Poon and Taj Derja in 2015, SF Bitcoin Devs, where they describe the system and the motivations for it. And that I was really inspired by that. I saw great potential in building layers of these decentralized systems that leverage one another to create and provide new capabilities and have new properties. And just the Bitcoin and the Lightning Network are the first examples of that.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what kind of stuff do you generally like contribute to or work on or review in Core? You know, it's kind of something like people don't really think about as far as normies go, is like, you know, you're just a Core developer or not.
Yeah, so I actually I didn't start by contributing to Core. I was at that time I was first interested in, I saw that the Lightning Node software was coming along. It was just becoming interoperable. So there's an interoperability test suite that was showing up on Reddit, for example, where they would kind of announce that more of the tests were passing, so that these node implementations were becoming more and more interoperable and closer to availability. And in that context, it seemed important to work on wallet software, because that's the software that naturally follows the node implementations. And so I went and found Zap Desktop on GitHub, and I started by contributing to Zap. And it was only after some months of that I started getting into Bitcoin, and that was in the context of Jack Mahler's. He had a concussion from an accident, and there was just kind of disrupted the project temporarily. And in that context, I decided to focus on something else, which in this case was Bitcoin Core. And I didn't really have specific goals. I more just wanted to get familiar with it. And the way I get familiar with a code base is I'll start by just looking for opportunities to sort of clean it up. So refactorings and refinements that I can find just by looking at any given piece of the code. So I'll just like review aspects of the code. I'll look for these opportunities. And this is kind of how I started, was doing that sort of thing. And the beauty of doing that, or at least the reason it works for me, is that it gives me early wins in terms of taking on a big project. You can have these incremental successes that that reward you along the way as you're increasing your understanding of the space. So I've been doing that now for a year and a half or 2 years, and I have continued to learn about the code base. I would say I call myself a student of Bitcoin. So I'm trying to learn. There's so much to learn about this, and I have learned, I continue to learn.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of stuff did you work on with Zap?
So for Zap, this was kind of early in the project. Most of the code had been written by Jack himself. And I believe I'd have to go review pull requests, but it would have been things like related to, I think I established CI and did other such things. I don't have a specific thing that comes to mind.
Okay, I just kind of shocked it myself here. I didn't do enough homework. I didn't know that you contributed to Zap. I kind of poking through your GitHub, I thought you just kind of forked that just to play with it a little bit.
I did a few things. It was there's a lot of work that goes into turning a project from a solo side project to becoming more of a multi-party collaborative development effort, and those were the sorts of things I worked on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, it's just I'm just sitting here marveling at the fact that there's like already developers out there that are kind of finding their way down to the base layer, coming in through second layers. Like, it's kind of things are a little further along than I would have thought. All right, so I guess, do you want to kind of
I feel like making one of those jokes where it's like, back in my day, developers came in through the first layer.
That meme will get made now. Watch. But I guess, do you want to kind of, move along into Snowball and maybe kind of break down what the plan there is?
Sure. Yeah. So this project came out of the Wyoming hackathon that happened earlier this year. And I went to Wyoming in part because I was curious to check out the place. I have a fondness for cowboy culture. I was born and raised in Texas, and I appreciate or respect certain aspects of it. And anyway, it happened that Justin Moon was also there, and we ended up collaborating because, like, we were the most distinctly Bitcoin people there in the space. So it was natural for us to partner on this thing. And we talked over ideas, and I had been really interested in the potential of local wireless mesh networking. So for example, you may have heard of Bridgeify, which is being used by or at least according to media reports, it's being used by people in Hong Kong to chat in a way that doesn't depend on the established centralized networks. And that got me thinking about, how can local mesh or wireless communications enhance Bitcoin and support Bitcoin? And at the same time, I had been aware of Samurai. I believe Samurai has a feature So Samurai is a privacy-oriented wallet. They have a lot of great features. They're doing a lot of research and development on building these things out. And but one video I had seen, I think, was involved doing a multi-round pay join between two wallets, where the communication mechanism was basically repeatedly showing different QR codes to the phone so that they could collaborate on the signing. And it seemed like, and I knew that that these kinds of collaborative efforts would necessarily be they would necessarily be real time. You'd necessarily have to have these communication steps given the limitations of the ECDSA and Schnorr signatures on that front. And that's just a property of the system. So given that's the case, wireless communications would be an ideal way of easing that interaction, right? Because, you know, a regular person is not going to go do this multi-round back and forth. So if we went to make coin joins and pay joins kind of a natural property of the system that a lot of people are engaging with, we really need to change the mode of interaction. And that's kind of the impetus for Snowball.
And for anyone who doesn't know, I think that feature you just mentioned is Cahoots, right? Shinobi, do you remember?
Possibly Stowaway.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I'm actually not sure what it's called at this point. I know it used to be Cahoots, but I think because they had I'm pretty sure they had the Cahoots feature, and they were also trying to work on something where you could keep adding stuff to the transaction and batch more before you actually submit it. I forget which is which.
Well, yeah, because Cahoots is the one where it's collaborative coin join transactions between two wallets, and then it's, I just look quickly at the support page and it says that it's similar to Stowaway, but yeah, one of those two.
There's a video on YouTube, it's a Stowaway collaborative Bitcoin transactions. We can post the link.
Okay, but yeah, it's in either one though. Yeah, it's the same kind of painful like scan again process.
Yeah.
But so, you know, like what are you guys kind of planning on you know, actually like building though in the long term in terms of actually trying to implement this and get this out there in the space?
Right. So the system in mind is that it's a feature for every wallet, for any wallet. And that when you open your wallet, so you have two parties making a transaction in real time, like in, you know, face to face. They're going to communicate using QR codes, but they can also, the QR code can encode additional information and can encode connection information around how to make the Bluetooth connection to them, how to make a secure connection with them. And supposing the recipient has this feature implemented, their QR code will include that information. And if the sender also has the feature implemented, then in scanning the QR code, they'll interpret that information and establish the connection with the counterparty wallet. And that will enable them the basis for doing this multi-step pay join process. So sending the initial intended transaction to the recipient and then enabling the recipient to collaborate and adding an input and doing other such things.
Okay, and so you kind of want to build this out as more just like a generalized like library or a module that's every wallet out there could just kind of incorporate or pull in or re-implement if they have to, and kind of just set like a standard on how to do this, right?
That's right. Yeah, so particularly most wallets don't engage in Bluetooth, and Bluetooth is notoriously touchy and difficult to work with. So having a solid implementation of that and having something that can be vetted and reviewed well will be a benefit to everyone, I think.
Mm-hmm. And like, how do you see the kind of the road going forward with that being in terms of getting from, your implementation to actually getting into the wallets? Like, what do you think is really going to be the driving factor to make that last jump there after you guys are done with the kind of reference implementation?
Yeah, so our plan to get started is to do the implementation, the integration work ourselves. So we've got a list of open source wallets that we're planning to integrate with and open pull requests around. And that should at least, I think, get the ball rolling. We should be able to, I think, get adoption from that. And hopefully, in the medium term, the wallet implementers take up some of this work themselves. We're looking to get, planning to apply to the Unknown Fund, which was just announced. This seems like a natural fit for that. But at the moment, it's three of us. It's myself, Justin Moon, and Rob Balzer.
Yeah, speaking of that, one of my questions I wanted to ask is what was behind your interest in working on privacy related stuff for Bitcoin? Like, is it are you do you see like a market demand and that's just what you're following in terms of your development focus, or do you have like a strong personal interest in working on this kind of stuff?
I suppose I could say I just sort of geek out on these things. So, for example, I think the idea of doing like broadcasting transactions via mesh networking is super cool. I think like the radio transmission stuff that Nick Szabo has worked on with I guess Alenu, and I think coin joins and pay joins are they're I think it's a. So in general, in Bitcoin, we talk about fungibility as the important element of the currency, and you can't really have fungibility without with strict visibility into the system. And I think chain analysis is inevitable, and as are the responses to chain analysis. The implementation of features that increase privacy, and I think it's a necessary part of the path forward to continue to enhance the privacy and to continue to have it be assailed by outsiders. So I'm happy to participate in moving things forward in that way. It's not a particular focus of mine. I generally just look for opportunities to improve the ecosystem, and they end up taking different forms and showing up in different places.
Okay, and like as far as the actual implementation your planning goes, I know based on everything you just said regarding your interest with mesh networking, that's going to be the primary communication medium. But like when you kind of get along to the point of actually putting a BIP proposal out there, like are you going to think about leaving that open for extensibility to other types of communication and coordination? Like another one that jumps to mind obviously is you can set up potentially Tor hidden services to coordinate this through.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a Bluetooth is just the most immediate and obvious one, but certainly like connecting over the internet, connecting over other services will be useful and will open up. For example, like you might want to have trusted counterparties that you want to participate in making these collaborative transactions with, just for your mutual benefit. Where you have trust in them in the sense that you aren't concerned about them surveilling you, which is a risk of certain other CoinJoin actions. So, and then certainly there are the things that are kind of nascent in terms of Gotenna and other such projects, and those will be as they become more available. I think it'll be useful to leverage them, and those are you could naturally fit that in if the protocol is designed well, then that connection information should be easily providable.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, kind of maybe not like a hard divide here, but just to kind of slide a little bit into or like towards just more general privacy discussion, you know, kind of just implementing the protocol to coordinate doing a coin join or a pay join and actually having some kind of heuristics to maximize the entropy you're introducing and how it's constructed are like two completely related or unrelated things. So like, are you guys thinking after, you know, ironing out the actual coordination and networking side of things, going on to work on any kind of anonymity maximizing tweaks to things? Like I know Adam Gibson and Belker and Laurent were talking about kind of adding inputs you don't really need when it makes sense to kind of throw things off even more and things along that line.
Yeah, definitely. So first of all, like the page join use cases is attractive in part because it's so easy to negotiate because the parties are there, they're active naturally in the interaction. And in terms of ensuring privacy or increasing privacy relative to that, what you can do is you can analyze the transaction that's produced by the pay join to ensure that it increases the number of possible interpretations of that transaction. So you can do subset sum analysis and other sorts of things. Samurai put out a great script, which is named Boltzmann. And that has some transaction analysis algorithms implemented. So you can imagine real time just applying that to the transaction that's being produced and then only broadcasting the pay join transaction if it significantly increased the privacy relative to the original.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, I kind of see, you know, potential to really go a long way further than that in terms of just like the two participants playing around with things, you know, like adding specific disconnected outputs of yours just to create a connection there and then a different one later to kind of add to the fractal set growth. Or like if you really see this implemented in scale in any kind of place, you know, even potentially completely disconnected purchases and transactions to the same business could all get lumped into a single pay join like this and just kind of, you know, adding to the level of efficiency and privacy you could get.
Yeah, I could definitely see things like that coming into being. There's I think establishing the initial feature set will kind of open the door to some of that by giving a form for those things to take and to interact with. So we're going to be intent on doing that.
Mm-hmm. All right, and then kind of another thing specifically with pay joins that I don't really know how to, whether to call this a problem or just a way things will change or whether I'm just being a complete idiot, because I was literally just blah brain fart. This next brain dump is pretty much a result of talking to somebody just a few hours ago. But if pay joins become a standard way of transacting with somebody, then I still kind of see the potential for analysis there in some way if you don't take extra steps. Because if you are constantly just pay joining with people to send them money and spinning off your own outputs that you're not using to receive things with, then eventually, you know, the businesses or the people receiving money start to stand out as these outputs that keep connecting disconnected clusters and transactions and having like incremental amounts added to them. So if you don't take the step to kind of recreate that same pattern with the change output to yourself, like there's still heuristics here that can be used to analyze the kind of set of connections here.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. And it's just I guess we kind of rolling back a little bit, the the intent of pay joins are, the first intent is to disrupt the common input ownership heuristic, which is an important heuristic for chain analysis. But there is this property, if you just always pay join, that you create this snowball UTXO that becomes a giant UTXO, and then you're no longer getting the benefit. Then all those transactions are correlated. You're no longer getting the benefit of multiple interpretations because it's clear which is the recipient's UTXO. Excuse me. So the way to, you want to build a system that avoids the worst of these problems, and the analysis itself can do that. So if you're doing this analysis and interpretations of the transaction, then those that will naturally avoid cases where the privacy is reduced relative to the default, and so then we can at least say according to those, to that analysis, that we've increased the privacy of this transaction. And certainly you can go beyond that to address the limitations that remain, but the combination, I think, of the analysis and the pay join work together to mitigate that.
Well, the thing I'm kind of worried about there is just pure economic incentives kicking in, and merchants just kind of doing things that way anyway. Like, why would I want to fragment and keep these disconnected UTXOs that each have a cost to maintain and use when I can just sum it all up in one?
Yeah, one interesting thing about Snowball relative to the earlier efforts, and the early efforts include Pay to Endpoint and Bus to Pay, and they is that Snowball is not particularly intended to be a merchant feature, although it certainly will be ideally included in their wallets and used by them by default. But it's the merchant use case that most introduces this challenge associated with having the cumulative UTXO from from continuously just receiving payments. And I guess merchants are most likely to have the bandwidth, more likely than an individual to have the bandwidth to make a plan about how they want to deal with consolidating their outputs and things like that, whether through Snowball or through separate transactions that would consolidate. I think Snowball will be an attractive approach because it, but I think privacy, people who are interested in privacy are more likely to adopt it than merchants, I would say. And so the mobile wallet personal use case, I think, is going to be helpful for adoption.
Mm-hmm. And one kind of side benefit, if things go that way, which I would honestly kind of prefer they do, at least until I think this whole new dynamic with outputs and the incentives like that, is just kind of having something like this standardized across wallets. It primes people for how interacting with second layers work, because there is really nothing out there except a sidechain in terms of second layers that doesn't require some kind of network interaction to actually make a transaction. And this kind of uses the privacy benefit to kind of smuggle in people getting used to that interactivity in a payment.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and certainly it's important to standardize this through BIP as well, and we'll be doing that. Although one of the appealing things of the use case or the user interface with respect to this is that it's, I believe, as minimal as it can be, and that you can have basically the same interaction that you already do as a wallet developer. You already have the QR code display, you have the kind of you'll use the same screens, the same interfaces, just communicate different information to them through them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of like there isn't the whole challenge of abstracting a whole new set of information. It's just there's now a little back and forth in the background, and then it just pushes to the network.
That's right.
Okay, so I'm gonna have to put you, Johnny, on the spot here in a second.
Let's hear it.
So, what else are you thinking about in terms of privacy in space, and what can be done to improve that?
Well, this is the most pressing thing, but I think future iterations of this will be, as we've been saying, interesting. I'm a fan of alternative modes of communication, mesh networking, and so on. As I said, I do have I have TX10a running at home, so if anyone wants to broadcast transactions through GoTenna and they're in the vicinity of my house, then they will get that relay from me.
Very nice. But let's see, how about Tor? Let's kind of shift over to the Lightning Network for a second here. Are you as agitated as I am that Tor for the networking communication is not just the default in everything out there, now that we're at the point where there are just wallets that normies are using?
Yeah, I've been this has been my main frustration with the Lightning Network for the past year or so, and now I'm really glad to see the latest releases of some of these wallets are starting to integrate Tor on the iOS side. So I'm thinking of Zap in particular. I think they released Tor integration in 0.5, and there are a few more. I have to salute the developers behind that. I know this is difficult to integrate this kind of background service on an iOS device. So I appreciate them for going through that effort.
All right, and since we're on Lightning, I feel it would be remiss of me not to bring up Lightning and CoinJoin and the kinds of combinations you can do there. Considering you kind of first fell into developing in this space through the Lightning, have you been thinking of any kind of ideas or possibilities in combining those two things?
It's interesting. I would definitely. I think I would look to do that maybe after Schnorr, because then you can leverage the composability to reduce potentially the cost. I think that's sort of related to the concept of channel factories, having maybe increasing privacy by having many parties involved in the channel creation. I don't have particular insight into that. I'm like SIPA, I'm not a cryptographer, and I leave that in part to other people. So one thing I would definitely recommend is Waxwing has a very good blog post on PayJoin. That was part of our inspiration for Snowball. You can find it on joinmarket.me, which is his join market. And there's a lot to find there.
Adam is one of the few people I quietly go ask if I'm being an idiot when some idea pops into my head.
Nice.
All right, well, Janine, you have any questions stewing around in your head?
Nope. If you guys want to talk more about the unknown fund, because I just saw that yesterday and I'm really curious, I believe they said that they have 75 million available.
That's right.
So have they actually published any criteria that they're looking for yet in terms of, what they're willing to give money to beyond, I believe all I've seen is that they said that they're going to give it to projects that directly or indirectly are improving privacy in Bitcoin.
That's right. They say preferred niches are personal data protection, tools for online anonymity, cryptocurrencies, blockchain associated with Bitcoin. Oh, actually, they're giving out $75 million in Bitcoin. It doesn't say they're strictly Bitcoin-related improvements.
Here's a question. What are you going to do if they give you a grant and send you stolen Bitcoin?
Well, I hadn't contemplated that.
That's a loaded question, right? Shinobi.
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure. I think I'll probably consult with a lawyer would be the answer.
Yeah, sorry. Just that I wasn't expecting this to come up. We were probably going to talk about it on the next regular show we do. So this is kind of a little teaser to where my head's at, where that is.
I think there's a lot of need for more for some kind of institute or lab to advance and develop these ideas in a more project-oriented kind of way. So Justin had a tweet recently that was, I think he said, so many Bitcoin ideas, so little time. And so there's basically a laundry list of possible hardware wallet improvements, privacy improvements, and other sorts of things we could do if we form the organization around it and like create a vehicle for that. So I'm hopeful that we can do something like that in the future.
Let me preface this with no shit flinging meant before I proceed to fling shit. But like this idea of incorporate an organization and then fund things through that, I am really not a fan of that idea. I feel like when that gets done, you're effectively guaranteeing a devolution to a monopoly in funding on stuff that doesn't come from corporations. And it's money's going to flow into this place because that's what they do. And then it's going to flow out to who they pick because that's how that works. And I'm just not a fan of that.
So I could see the critique or the concern around centralization. And I think it's a valid concern, and I don't think we should have we shouldn't walk into or wander into a situation where we have some kind of overbearing, overarching entity that's controlling the situation. On the other hand, there are reasons for research institutions, there are reasons for foundations, and that is that you can leverage the combination of people to greater effect than you might otherwise be able to do if you did not gather them together in a significant way. So like by increasing the communication and so on. And I think the thing for us as Bitcoiners to do is to be attentive to the ecosystem and to keep our eye on the relative scale of organizations and to kind of look for opportunities to diversify funding, diversify employment, diversify the types of institutions and how they're controlled. But I don't think we should expect a future in which there are no such institutions, because that would ultimately undermine the ability of the ecosystem to develop and advance.
It's not that I think there shouldn't be any kind of organization or planning around that. It's I would rather just leave that void so that companies have to fill it to meet their own interests. And like at least that guarantees an alignment of incentives to some degree. Whereas trying to create like a nonprofit or those types of organizations, you're effectively giving like those companies an out to just throw money at that and outsource their whole involvement and decision making and how that aligns with things. It's just throw money and they'll handle it.
I'll push back because I think it's not such a bad thing to separate the research and development from the institutions that have funds. So, for example, I've been critical of exchanges for not supporting the Bitcoin ecosystem as much as I think they should, given the extent to which they profit off of it. And the challenge is, it's naturally the case that inside these institutions, the whole organization is built around the idea of pursuing the revenues that are their focus, right? So the whole incentives of the operation pull it away from effectively engaging in this other work. And this is a problem in all sorts of cases. Like one, I like to recommend The Innovator's Dilemma, which talks about the situation in which companies are unable to transition technologies because they're so focused on what becomes the legacy technology that they don't take up the new one. And in that, they talk about the importance of basically isolating, protecting any new efforts from the incentives of the surrounding organization. So you need to give them basically separate funding, separate leadership, so that they aren't, so that their cause is pursued and not diminished by the priorities of the surrounding organization.
See, I don't think that's really going to be an issue in the long term. And I think that what we're kind of seeing with exchanges right now is just a blip on the radar. Like the dominant exchanges in this space are not going to be here in 10 or 15 years unless they get bought out by big legacy players instead of them starting from scratch, or they somehow can compete with those legacy players. And I mean, it eventually goes to a place where that type of business is absolutely going to be throwing money at the kinds of development that the current businesses aren't, because they will want to trust minimize everything they possibly can in their interactions with other businesses. And you maximize that by funding development. And you know, it's just, I'm enjoying this little mini debate here, but we just, I think, went way off down a rabbit hole.
Well, it's definitely an interesting conversation. I'm pondering how to respond. So, but I don't have an immediate one. So,
well, Janine, bring us back to some kind of coherence. It's privacy on Bitcoin. Wasn't that what we were talking about?
Yeah, I think that's what we were talking about. Let's see. Well, I mean, it's kind of related to privacy, but also security. I just saw, was that this morning? It was either this morning or yesterday. I saw a report that at least two individuals have been arrested in the investigation to figure out who's been SIM swapping people and stealing their cryptocurrency. And I haven't looked into it. Yeah, I haven't looked into the details of that yet, but I feel like that the kinds of attacks like that, the people are, you know, getting SIM swapped because these attackers know that they can get a financial reward directly from doing that. I feel like a lot of the, at least in security, but maybe also privacy, the innovations that are going to happen in Bitcoin to make people safer are going to end up spilling over into other consumer applications and hopefully whole devices as well, because this is still pretty much out of hand and crazy, and the amount of money that's being lost is insane. But it's highlighting the fact that so many of these devices are completely shit in terms of their security standards.
Yeah, I'm actually relatively familiar with this space because I'm looking into creating alternative. And the problem is really with the mobile carriers. They have, you know, they have a user base that does not have the security concerns in general that the cryptocurrency user base does. And there's an extent, the cryptocurrency user base is a relatively small component of their user base. So they're trying to focus on, you know, holding market position and growing and things like that. They've got these massive bureaucracies essentially. And so their prioritization of this issue is less than we would like. And I think the proper answer to that is to create institutions that are that answer to the Bitcoin public and like prioritize, and by virtue of having cryptocurrency people as the user base, prioritize and elevate security to the point where it properly protects the users from this kind of attack.
Yeah, and one of the things I've been talking with some people about lately is that one of the things that's really hard in terms of, because like a lot of these security vulnerabilities, I mean, these people are exploiting them to steal cryptocurrency, but obviously there's a whole industry around using it just for surveillance and, you know, surreptitious hacking where the victim doesn't even know that they've been compromised. And one of the things that people have been wanting to do is an easy way to change the IMEI number, which is, for anyone who doesn't know, that's the International Mobile Equipment Identity, and it basically identifies your specific device and ties it to the SIM card. And the weird thing is that there's a bunch of people, like we were talking about this, and everyone kind of assumes that changing that number would be illegal because it's like that would be super effective at, you know, countering surveillance. And but that's actually not the case. Like as far as I'm aware, there isn't, I mean, there might be in some authoritarian countries, but as far as I'm aware, I haven't seen evidence yet of a country that actually says you're not allowed to do that. But there's this assumption that they would make it illegal if people actually did that. And I find that really weird.
Can you restate that for, just to be clear? So you're saying the user changes their IMEI in order to like separate themselves from whatever identity is associated with the IMEI that already exists?
Yeah, because I'm assuming that like these mobile carriers, they're or even any networks they connect to, they're probably, you know, they're probably matching the SIM card with these numbers so that they can, you know, even if you change the SIM card out, they can still track you based on that number for the device and everything.
The only place I've seen reference to this is that you can, as the telecommunications company, you can, in communication with the SIM card, identify the IMEI of the device. And so you can use that as an anti-tampering measure, as some kind of protection against, you know, theft or transfer of the SIM card. But at the same time, people changing their phones is a relatively common occurrence. So I don't see why it could be, or how it could be prevented, or why it should be prevented.
Because some senile person in government said so.
It's, as far as I know, not illegal, so.
Okay, but kind of circle a little bit back to Bitcoin with this. Like, you know, all the kinds of steps you can take to, you know, protect your privacy as far as the transaction linkages on chain go, like they kind of don't matter if you don't protect yourself on a network level, on the level of metadata. So like really, how do you think we're gonna handle over the next 10 or 20 years the fact that despite all of these privacy improvements on chain, like there's still going to be regular interaction with all kinds of businesses that create fresh metadata tags?
Yeah, it's a real challenge. I think there's, in some sense, there is no absolute privacy for a person who exists in the world. You basically have to, the idea that you emit no information is kind of an unrealistic scenario. And so I think a good way of thinking about it is instead, based on the anonymity set, And so there was an interesting blog post, I'm not sure who by, but I guess we can look it up later, which did, it analyzed Death Note from the perspective of a security analyst. So basically, in this person writing these names in this book to cause people to die, how could they be identified? And one of the ways they were identified was by revealing information which reduced their anonymity set. So that included doing it at certain times of the day, which sort of indicated that a certain area of the world. So you can just say that if only some subset, if some percentage of the world lives in this place, that this area of the world that is active during those hours of the day, then that population is now your anonymity set, which is, which you lose a certain number of bits of security in doing, in cutting down from the larger set to the smaller set. So the so that would be a way to think about it, is like, how do you participate in a large privacy set?
Okay, that I love that you used the Death Note comparison there, but you also literally just took that down to exactly like the degree I wanted to go into. I mean, it's like that there is going to be enough of a metadata trail, unless all kinds of leaky holes get patched up, that the bigger Bitcoin grows, it turns into a surveillance system almost, if you don't patch up those holes. Because yeah, you can, and it's not even just like times. You can look at the timing analysis of something propagating across the Bitcoin network and probably narrow it to a region even smaller than just this part of the world, and down and down and down. So like, you know, how are we gonna kind of mitigate that, considering the fact that each thing is just a single patch?
Yeah, it's I think it's going to be an ongoing challenge, and the general sentiment I think is that there's not ever absolute security or absolute privacy, but there's good enough security and good enough privacy, and you know whether security or privacy are good enough by the fact that the wall still stands at the end of the day. And so the only thing, so systems that do not respond to the threat of this kind of privacy intrusion will not survive, because they will not, because people will not use a system that puts them at risk, I guess. But that also depends on the scale of the risk and the sort of form of that risk. So I would say it's like an ongoing effort to refine, and we will only know through the failures when it's not living up to the proper expectation. And in absent that, we have to kind of apply analysis and theoretical consideration.
So pretty much just grit your teeth and hope you aren't using something that fucked it up.
It's not easy. Operational security is not easy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess, you know, that seems like a fitting point to end it in my mind. So I guess, you know, Janine or Ben, do you guys have any kind of final thoughts you want to throw out there, or any thoughts you want to end on?
I do.
Go for it.
So my final thought, not to stimulate the debate about whether to make an institute again, but if anyone does make an institute about privacy stuff in Bitcoin, please call it the Clusterfucks, because I want to, I love that concept by Nopara, and I want someone to redo the Clusterfuck badge from the US military and make it into a Bitcoin privacy thing, because that would be so funny.
I will support the meme.
Yeah, fine by me.
All right,
I don't know if there's any kind of restrictions on the use of swear words in the name of a foundation or institute or whatever, but that would be, I would, if you pick that name, I'll like I'll be behind you.
Well, you can only find out by trying. But I guess on that note, Ben, do you have anything you kind of want to say in a final thought or tell anybody where they can kind of keep up with what you're doing?
Sure. Yeah. I think it's just important for all of us to actively consider what are the possible advancements for the space and how can we contribute to them. I think it's easy to live in a way or to fall into a stance of being a passive participant in something when this is Bitcoin benefits from what we can do to advance it and support it, and you know, the future users will appreciate you for your efforts.
All right. Well, on that note, I hope you guys enjoyed this. Hope the foundation argument wasn't too derailing, and we'll catch you next time.
Thanks.
Bye. Is it? Yes, it is.